This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Broadway icon John Cameron Mitchell channels the essence of his glam rock icon, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, for one night only at Arts Centre Melbourne this July. So put on some makeup, turn up the A-track, and pull the wig down from the shelf. John Cameron Mitchell, July 10 at Arts Centre Melbourne. Book now. Joy sponsor.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast, brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture. Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Macca and Tass, Senator Dean Smith and Miss Misha Ketchell from The Conversation. Misha is the editor. Tass, where do you want to kick off? What do you want to start with?
Well, before we do kick off, I'd like to just acknowledge Brad. Thank you for your comment. Yes, we do agree to disagree sometimes and remain civil with each other. It's great that we've got some feedback from some of our listeners. Keep it coming.
And he says, agree to disagree, but being polite to each other. He says, Dean, a shame many in the Parliament can't manage that, which probably brings us to
the very topic that we want to talk about.
Which is parliamentary behaviour. When you look out the window here, you look up and you see the State Parliament. I'm one of those people that from time to time watches it, and it's pretty uncivil. But the Federal Parliament, so the House of Representatives and the Senate, some of the behaviour of our politicians, and Dean made a comment, an observation earlier, that when school kids come to see the Parliament, they have a particular area in the House of Reps which is glassed off, so the teachers can actually tell the kids what's going on. And probably if the kids behaved in the classroom as some of our elected representatives, they'd be standing outside the headmaster's office.
But more importantly, Macca, during the course of the week, one of the senators, Senator David Lanholm, is that how you pronounce it? Lanholm, made some comments that have actually struck a nerve with our community. Mm. And this has generated quite a lot of debate. It's brought in a whole lot of other commentators, including the Prime Minister, who's I can't even pronounce the word. Has slapped.
He's issued some opprobrium.
Okay, there you go. Misha, why has this issue gained so much traction in the last week?
I think it really feeds into a deeper issue, which is about how we treat each other and how we talk particularly about women and you know, our private lives. And I think one of the key things about Lanholm's comments is the way in which it mobilises this idea about sexual propriety and sexual conduct. The feminist author Eva Cox wrote a piece for The Conversation this week talking about the Madonna whore dichotomy and this idea that, you know, women who have sex with lots of partners are somehow lesser. And I think that really society's attitudes have changed. People understand now that, you know, it's a basic human freedom. You can have sex with who you want as many times as you want, and it's a basic human right, and it's not something that should be brought into the public sphere to discredit you or as a form of political ammunition.
So why has this issue generated such hot emotions?
Well, I think that's one part of it. Just I think people can feel the sort of, you know, I mean, Sarah Hanson-Young used the term slut-shaming, and I think people are very angry about that. There was also a really interesting article in the Saturday paper this morning, which included an interview with Sarah Hanson-Young and some other senators talking about the culture within the Senate and basically saying that there is this sort of culture of grubby off-mic sexual innuendo across the chamber. What we're talking about before, which is about that area that's, you know, sort of glassed off where, you know, children come to watch parliamentary proceedings, for example, this is about a level of sort of sexual innuendo that's happening off the microphones but across the floor that some women, some female senators are reporting sort of as intimidating or inappropriate.
In fact, I heard Cheryl Kuno came out purporting to that again just last night. Dean, what do you think? I mean, is this really occurring in Parliament?
Well, I've not seen the report in the Saturday paper this morning, but I think Misha's point about, you know, what it is this clash between what is appropriate in the private sphere and what's appropriate in the public sphere. And I think what is happening is that there's this sort of changing expectation about what is appropriately public, and I think that what's happening here is that people are perhaps not keeping up with community sentiment in terms of what they might have regarded as private sphere, private comments, private banter, now being held accountable for that because people see these as public sphere, public matters. I think there's a big issue here for parliamentarians, and that is that how a parliamentarian might see the delineation between a public and private sphere for themselves might be very, very different to how their colleagues see it or how the community sees it. And it's that changing expectation, whether it's changing expectations one-on-one, parliamentarians between parliamentarians, or that changing expectation that the community have. That's the change that is happening. I think some people might be accommodating and adjusting to that better than others.
I think this is also an interesting question of consistency. I mean, I have argued very strongly that I think it was inappropriate for the Daily Telegraph to reveal the relationship that Barnaby Joyce had with Vicky Campion. And again, for me, I would put that in the category of legitimate private sphere that only enters the public sphere when there is a necessary connection with public life. So if there had been evidence...
See, we have to agree to disagree on this one,
you know,
because I actually think when you have a community leader who is purporting a particular set of values and yet in his own life actually practices something quite contrary, I think we have every right to question what he's on about.
Yeah, my view is that your private sexual life, your personal relationships, are a separate sphere, and you can critique the ideas that a politician brings to public life on the basis of those ideas without needing to go to their private
life.
But
not when Barnaby Joyce was actually telling us what was appropriate for our sexual lives.
Well, I mean, I don't agree with Barnaby Joyce's position on that, but I would argue that just as it's inappropriate to go to Sarah Hanson-Young's private life, I would say it's inappropriate for Barnaby. Mm.
Misha, do you think that that a public figure, parliamentarian or, you know, celebrity, gives that right up by their conduct? So, for example, if a parliamentarian brings into the public sphere, you know, glamorous, healthy family shots, children, prams, etc., are they giving up that private sphere, or does that public private sphere divide hold firm irrespective of how they might, you know, use their private sphere to sort of advance their sort of political narrative or their political imaging?
I think that use of your private life does make that distinction harder to maintain. And you do certainly get an argument that if you're presenting one sort of narrative about your life, somebody in the media has a right to represent a corrective narrative or to fill out that picture. I think that that's absolutely true. I would just argue that we are in a better position overall if we try to maintain that distinction. You know, people like Barnaby, you know, doing that paid interview certainly don't help maintaining that distinction. But I think that distinction is really valuable. And I think that what we're seeing with Sarah Hanson-Young is actually a really good example of that, because her personal conduct in her personal life is being used as political ammunition. And to me, that just seems entirely inappropriate and unhelpful.
Very slippery slope.
Yeah. Mm. In terms of these, you know, these comments, Misha, and the tone of them, and Dean, have we reached peak sludge?
Sludge?
Well,
I don't think so.
You know, I mean, I think it's a pretty appalling situation. What's, you know, the nature of the debate and the tone of the... I don't even call it debate. But, you know, it disappoints me that when... You know, as a community, you know, as a country, we face so many challenges, yet this is the sort of stuff that's occupying so much of the news, or so much certainly of the mainstream news. I think it's peak sludge. Like we've had, you know, peak oil. Have we got peak sludge? Or is it just going to continue, Dean and Misha? What do you think?
Well, let's be very careful here, because 226 federal parliamentarians, and the conversation has focused on the conduct of two of them with each other. It would be very, very unfair for those parliamentarians who are acting with consistency, who are acting with authenticity, who are trying to navigate that public versus private sphere, to then sort of paint them all with the same brush. I think that's very, very unfair. I'm an optimist in this. I think that what this might have demonstrated to some people is how behaviour is important and language is important, and perhaps when we go back to Parliament in August, some people might be privately changing the way they conduct themselves.
Misha?
And I'm also hoping that it'll reinforce the idea that private lives should be off limits, and that if we're going to sort of traverse that boundary, we need a very compelling reason to do so. And I think in this case, there wasn't one.
Saturday Magazine Joy 94.9, Macca, Tass, Misha Ketchell from The Conversation, Senator Dean Smith, or Senator Dean Marriage Equality Smith, in the studio. Religious freedoms. This is, there was the review commissioned by the Prime Minister, headed by Philip Ruddock, that has reported. We haven't seen the report back to the government. Have you seen it, Dean?
No, not yet.
Why haven't they shown you? Are they keeping it from you?
Well, they're keeping it from everyone just at the moment, but I think we can be very, very reassured that it will come, and perhaps it might come a little bit more quickly than we think, given the front page of today's Australian newspaper.
Misha?
Sorry, what was the question? Oh. I just missed that for a minute.
No, so with, you know, the report, the Religious Freedom Report, and we all have, I suppose, hopes and fears in terms of what it might contain.
Have you seen the report?
Have you seen it?
The Philip Ruddock report, no.
Have you received any intelligence about it?
Only what I read on the front page of the Australian Citizen.
Oh.
Well.
Ah, right.
Well, yeah, that's two copies they sold.
Yes.
So, Dean, I understand you've actually read Dan Tehan's speech in full. So what was the point that he was trying to make?
Well, this is a regular lecture that happens from the, or by the Thomas More Society. Those people that know their religious history will know that Thomas More was a prominent Catholic during the reign of Henry VIII. He was asked to take an oath by the king. The king, of course, was wanting to distance himself or separate from the church in Rome. And Thomas More, being a strong Roman Catholic, decided that he would keep his oath to God and not take the oath with the king, who wanted to distance himself from the church in Rome. Anyway, but that's all the history, and if you want to read the speech, Dan goes through that. It's an interesting speech. I actually don't think there's a lot in it. There's not a lot of new information in it, and the key proposition that Dan Tehan makes, who of course is the Minister for Social Services, the key proposition that he makes is that it might be time for a Religious Discrimination Act in Australia. Now, this is actually not a new idea, and those people who have read closely the submissions that were made to the Ruddock Review will know that the idea of importing into federal anti-discrimination law protection for religious belief is an idea that was put about by a number of organisations, including the Australian Human Rights Law Centre.
What do you think of that idea, Misha?
I'd be interested in the evidence that people are already being discriminated against on religious grounds. I think the case that we actually need this needs to define what the problem is first. And it seemed to me that what Dan Tehan was saying, there was a lot of sort of fairly emotive rhetoric, but not strong evidence. I mean, he was saying things like, you know, there's an creeping encroachment from the state into religious beliefs.
Really?
I'd like to know what that is. He said that there's a growing influence of empowered minorities, and basically there sort of seems to be this idea that people who have religious beliefs are part of a mainstream that is now somehow besieged by these minorities, running through certainly the reporting of the speech. I think that's playing to perhaps what some people feel, but I don't think it's true. I don't think there's actually evidence that that is what's happening. So I think it's a response to a problem that doesn't really exist.
This is a critical point. When I met with Philip Ruddock and other members of the review panel, I made a number of points to them. The most important point I made was that it was critical that evidence be demonstrated, that evidence be provided, that the current laws that exist in Australia are deficient. Now, this was a recurring point, a recurring theme that I and others made when we debated religious freedom in the context of same-sex marriage, firstly in the Senate Select Committee process, secondly when the amendments came before the Senate, thirdly, when amendments came before the House of Representatives, and now in the Ruddick Review, let us see the evidence. And what I mean by that, by recounting those three separate forums, is that, in my opinion, nowhere was there compelling evidence that in the Australian context there was a significant or real disruption to people's religious worship and religious belief. Now, it may well be that in the last few months there's substantial amount of evidence, then I will expect to see that evidence in the Ruddick Review. Now, what we can be very, very sure of is that in none of the commentary we've heard over the last 6 months is anyone arguing that the Marriage Act itself needs to be amended. That's a significant achievement.
Yes, it is.
That demonstrates that the way that the same-sex marriage amendments were crafted were correct, and irrespective of the position that some people might have taken on amendments, the fact was the overwhelming majority of House of Representatives members endorsed an unamended bill. We can remember the images of that.
Yes.
Huge numbers of House of Representatives members sitting on one change, and even in the Senate, you know, it was an overwhelming majority. So I agree with Misha. Evidence. What is the evidence?
Misha, do you think that this is this whole debate is actually bringing back into the foreground for our discussion and our consideration the need for a human rights charter?
I'm not quite sure it's necessarily been formally a part of the debate, but I actually do think there would be a benefit in a human rights charter in Australia. I think it would be helpful to define what those rights are and how we conceive of them and how we protect them. I think probably what we're looking at really is a phenomenon or a debate that confuses the distinction between the secular state and private religious belief. I mean, my view has always been that in a multicultural, multi-belief society like Australia, what you need is you need your state to be secular to encompass a wide range of beliefs. And it seems that partly the impetus for these protections of religious freedom seem to be more about providing some sort of guarantee for cultural centrality for certain religious beliefs. This idea of encroachment, for example, the language about an encroachment on religious beliefs, it sort of basically seems to be saying that these beliefs, their role as sort of central to our culture is somehow under threat, which I don't think is necessarily true, but I don't think, even if it were true, the way you fix it is not by changing the secular state, not by changing our laws. There are actually three examples that Dantine sort of talked about or reported in The Australian, one of which is the same-sex marriage laws, one of which is euthanasia, and the third one of which is sort of the sanctity of the confessional and proposals to change, reporting requirements for priests if people in the confessional disclose sexual abuse. So they're the sort of the three things that have been presented as things that may encroach upon religious freedoms. But in every case, I think basically what we're talking about is laws that are the perpetuation of business as usual, which is the state makes laws for the good of society overall, and religious freedom proceeds in a separate sphere, but always subject to the law.
I'm surprised the subject of abortion didn't come up in those.
Yeah,
that argument's been lost. Dean, does the law of the state trump canon law?
Well, I don't think it's. I think they coexist, and it goes. It's interesting. We've heard a lot about spheres this morning. I think they coexist, but with very, very clear delineations. But the difference, I think, an important difference here is that you voluntarily subscribe to religious laws. You voluntarily subscribe to state laws by leaving our country. So I think that voluntary versus compulsory element is very, very important. But if I could just go back to this religious freedom issue, because there's an element in this debate that is missing. And I'm very, very comfortable for my colleagues to have discussions about religious freedom, but I will not accept any winding back of anti-discrimination laws in our country that target LGBTI community or any other community. So I'm very comfortable for the Prime Minister to lead a discussion around religious freedom, but any hint that that involves winding back our well-established anti-discrimination laws will be opposed because it's not in the Australian interest and it's not the Australian way. The postal survey outcome demonstrated that overwhelmingly.
We elect politicians to pass the laws. We don't elect bishops. So what is the validity, if we all believe in democracy and representational democracy, we elect politicians to pass laws which are then signed off by the Queen's representative. That's the process
I'm
we
not
have.
Gonna, I'm not biting.
You're
not,
no, don't bite.
No, no. I'm
sitting
but,
he's trying
still.
To set you up. Yes. Don't.
But this is how we make laws, right? We don't elect bishops, and we don't elect religious leaders. And if religious law has to coexist, then here's a novel idea. How about every member of the church gets to vote on whether they agree with canon law, whether they agree with the sanctity of the confessional?
Well,
it's
no
a bit of a long stretch. I don't believe in divine right.
No one in our country is above the law, whether they wear civilian clothing or whether they wear religious clothing. No one is above the law. I think that the issue around the confessional is a very, very interesting one, because the question I asked myself when we were talking about earlier about community expectations around language and about how we treat, how parliamentarians treat each other, I wonder exactly where community expectation is now around the sanctity of the confessional.
What do you think, Misha?
Well, I think it would depend which community you asked.
Exactly.
And obviously there is a community that feels very strongly about this. I mean, there have been reports about priests who have indicated that they would be willing to go to jail to protect the sanctity of the confessional, and that's a personal individual belief. And, I mean, I do have some sympathy with the position in which they would find themselves, but I do think that at the end of the day, the law of the land, the law of the secular state, has to trump the religious belief, and if you have a conscientious objection to the law and then you, that makes you behave in a certain way, then that has to be your individual choice. But there has to be a hierarchy, and I think that the point you're making is a really good one, which is about religious leaders not being elected and not having that same legitimacy that comes from a democratic process. And that is precisely why we have this hierarchy where the law of the land trumps everything else.
Consorting with criminals is against the law. Hiding a crime is against the law. The confessional is not the place for church leaders to put themselves above the law and to look the other way, albeit in a very small number of cases, granted, that have probably come to light through a confessional. But I ask them, ask their God, whether their God thinks that's all right. That's the question. And they know what the answer is. And the reason that they won't ask their members of their religion whether they agree is they know the result.
I think we're out of time, Macca.
We are.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.